Well, let's open to Mark 9. And we'll begin at verse 13 here in just a moment. Thank you, Wayne. Okay, let's begin with a prayer. Oh God, we have gathered here tonight again to open up your magnificent word, especially the gospel according to Mark. And we want to see Jesus. We want to see him in action. We want to hear what he's going to say to people. We just want to see how he's going to deal with whatever comes his way and whatever he confronts, that we might learn to be like him, for we are his disciples. And so we want to think as he did and just base our whole lives on him. For we know, as Paul said, that there's no other foundation that can be laid than that which is laid, and that's Jesus Christ. In the name of our Savior, we offer our prayer. Amen. Okay, so we had left off at 12, and then Jesus, as you remember here, is speaking to his disciples. They've just asked a question in verse 11. Why do the scribes say that Elijah must come first? And then he said, you know, it's true, verse 12, Elijah is coming first and restores all things. And how is it written concerning the Son of Man that he must suffer many things and be treated with contempt? But I say to you that Elijah has also come, and they did to him whatever they wished, as it is written of him. And remember, they're bringing up Elijah because they had just seen Elijah in the Transfiguration. So in their minds, Elijah's coming after Jesus, but he was supposed to have come before Jesus. So what's going on in verse 13? What does Jesus mean that Elijah had already come? Yes, he was. And one of the other gospel writers says that the disciples finally figured out he's referring to John. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. Look at Luke chapter 1. See, what they were thinking is that Elijah himself has to be coming in the flesh. But look what Gabriel, the angel Gabriel, said to Zacharias, the soon-to-be father of John the Baptizer. He said this in verse 16 of Luke 1. And he will turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God. He will also go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah. And then Gabriel quotes from Malachi to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. Okay, so according to Gabriel, in what way was Elijah like? I mean, John was like Elijah. Earl.
He was one of the prophets. He was a prophet of God, and he was that was the purpose of the prophets, is to guide the people through the ages until Jesus came and lead them to Jesus. That was their purpose, and that's what John came to be, the preparer. To prepare the way for the Lord. And so he was the end of the prophets before Jesus came and was the fulfillment of it and brought the people to Jesus and prepared the way.
Okay. Phil? Well, okay, now in verse 17, there's a point of comparison between Elijah and John. What's that point? Or actually, two points. He came in the spirit and power of Elijah. You know, I mean, he thought the way Elijah did. He even lived the way Elijah did. And he spoke boldly, just like Elijah did. Elijah feared no one. Well, except for Jezebel. Now, one time he feared Jezebel. And he ran for his life to get away from her. Pardon?
And I don't remember how far, but it was a long, long ways.
That's right, yeah. And, of course, she was queen. You know, I mean, if the dictator is a 10-year-old kid and he wants to kill you, it's going to happen, you know. But Elijah, I mean, he was something else. Not disrespectfully, but boldly, he would tell kings what the truth is. And John did too. Why did John end up losing his head? It was not lawful for you to have your brother Philip's wife. And, of course, she was offended by that. And eventually, you know, we'll see later how she used that to cut his head, get his head cut off. Okay, and also, let me look at my notes here real quickly. Yeah, go to 2 Kings 1:8. Because I want you to see how Elijah looked, his appearance, the way he lived. 2 Kings 1:8. And remember, the king of Israel has sent some messengers to go find out whether he's going to be healed of his illness. And Elijah confronts these messengers. And in 2 Kings 1:8 it says, then the messengers go back to the king and he wants to know what's going on. So they answered him, "A hairy man wearing a leather belt around his waist." You know, that's what he looked like. And he said, "It is Elijah the Tishbite." Now go back to Mark 1 and verse 8, or 6. Mark 1, 6. Yes. It didn't say hairy coat. Oh, okay. Well, let me see if there's a footnote on that or something. Yeah, mine doesn't give any kind of reference on that. It just says he was a hairy man wearing a leather belt around his waist. And that kind of sounds a lot like Mark 1:6. Now, John was clothed with camel's hair and with a leather belt around his waist. And he ate locusts and wild honey. Yeah. Well, and after John had been thrown into prison, John sent some of his disciples to Jesus with a question. Jesus answers the question, those men leave, and then Jesus begins to speak to the crowds about John. And he talks about his clothing and his appearance. You know, and saying that, you know, he was not a reed shaken in the wind. He wasn't wearing smooth clothing. I mean, he was a rough character. He lived out in the wilderness, and that's where he did his preaching. And people would go out there to him. So anyways, go ahead. Gene.
He was an hairy man.
Referring to which one? Okay, so Elijah. Yeah.
So I guess you go back
Yeah. Yep. Okay, now let's go back to Mark 9, verse 14. And when he came to the disciples, he saw a great multitude around them and scribes disputing with them. Remember what we've just looked at was Jesus and three of his disciples, Peter, James, and John, coming down from the mountain. And he had that conversation that we just looked at with them. So now he meets up with the other nine and a crowd that is gathered around. 15. Immediately when they saw him, all the people were greatly amazed and running to him, greeted him. And he asked the scribes, "What are you discussing with them?" Then one of the crowd answered and said, "Teacher, I brought you my son who has a mute spirit. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down, he foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. So I spoke to your disciples that they should cast it out, but they could not." Now, I don't know if this is what they were disputing about, why the disciples could or could not cast the demon out of this boy, or if this man was just part of the crowd and he sees Jesus, he's got a desperate situation, and he just kind of just takes over and says, "Jesus, here's my problem." Okay, so now Jesus addresses that. But look what he says. He answered him and said, "O faithless generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him to me." Why do you think Jesus said those things?
It was almost as if he was disgusted with the apostles.
Yeah, because he's going to talk to them a little bit later. You know, that they should have been able to do it. Because they had the power. But they could not in this case. I think Jesus will imply later that there was something they forgot to do. And also, Jesus kind of got to the point where when people only saw him for the miraculous things he could do, that disturbed him. He wanted them to see what he could bring for their spirits. But they kept being focused on the flesh. Okay, so verse 20. Then they brought him, the boy, to him. And when he saw him, immediately the spirit convulsed him, and he fell on the ground and wallowed, foaming at the mouth. Man, what a sight that must have been. So he asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. And often he has thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." You don't say that to Jesus. Okay, because look how he responds to that. Verse 23. "If you can believe," or I like the way a lot of other translations say it, "if you can, all things are possible to him who believes." What did the man say that was off base?
"If you can."
Yeah, "if you can."
But he did say, "Take pity on us and help us."
Sure.
He thought he knew he
could. Yeah, but why is he going to Jesus if he's not really sure whether Jesus can help or not?
Lack of faith.
Jesus is indicating a lack of faith on his part. Yes. Well,
not meaning that there was a question of whether he could or not. It's more like you're transporting words. You should be saying, "Could you do something?"
Well, seeing the way Jesus responded, and then the way the man responded back to him, I think it really was he wasn't quite sure if Jesus could help. Now, he knew that Jesus had some kind of ability. Otherwise, he would not be going to Jesus in the first place. Right. Well, but I think the problem was, is he, while he believed Jesus could do, you know, while he believed Jesus could do some things, he wasn't sure if Jesus could handle this one. Now, this one may be too big for you, Lord. Now, if you can do something here, fine. But I may have presented something to you that's bigger than anything you've done so far. Right. I mean, why? And what about in our prayers? How do we pray to God? Do we ever approach Him with the same thing, questioning whether He can really do something or not? See, whether the man realized what he was doing or not, it's really becoming now a test of whether Jesus can do anything. When really it's a test whether we believe whether he can do something. It's not supposed to be a test of him. It's supposed to be a test of us. Do I have the faith or not? Rather than does he have the ability or not? I mean, let's look at it this way. Let's assume that the man is not sure whether Jesus can help or not, and Jesus does not rebuke him as he does in verse 23. But he goes ahead and heals the boy, you know, casts the demon out. How will it be known whether Jesus is the one who really did it? Maybe it might be determined, well, it was time for it to happen. Or maybe an idol did it, or who knows what. I mean, why should God answer our prayers if I'm not really sure whether he is capable of doing something or not? Because when he does do it, how do I know whether I can thank him for having done it? Because if I don't think he can do it, then maybe it happened for some other reason. Do you follow what I'm saying?
It would have happened anyway.
Yeah, it may have just happened anyway. And you know, sometimes that happens, doesn't it? The people are sick, let's say, for example, not with a demon possession, but they're sick. And the family doesn't believe, the doctors who are working on the sick person doesn't believe, and nobody prays to God, and the person gets better. When normally the person should have died. Does that ever happen? Sure it does. Why did it happen? Did God intervene in that case? We don't know. Was it just that maybe it wasn't as bad as they thought? Or maybe that person's body suddenly was able to conquer the problem? You know, who knows? It's left up. And God doesn't want it just to be left up to your best guess. He wants us to know that He's truly working in His lives. And I think that's what's going on here. He doesn't understand that the Creator is standing right there in front of Him. That's right. That's right. And it needs to be said right here too. He just doesn't understand who this man is. He's the Son of God. He created everything. He created the earth. He created the human bodies. He created the demons, although he didn't create them as demons. But he created everything. Anything that exists, except for God himself, anything that exists, he made it. Pardon?
Was this called a demon or was it just epilepsy?
Well, yeah, he says he has a mute spirit in verse 17. Right, so. Right, so it's some kind of evil spirit. Because he's trying to destroy the boy, throwing him into the fire, trying to drown him in water. So there's something about him that's unholy or evil.
My NIV and it says, it actually puts the word death in there.
Right. Yeah,
I don't know whether yours is in the King James or not.
Well, I haven't gotten that far yet. Yeah, in verse 25 it does. Right.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah. But back in verse 17, the man just said,
yeah,
that's okay. That's all right. And sometimes we saw in another context, I don't remember which one it was, where it was used interchangeably with an unclean spirit and a demon. I don't know if that was back in chapter 7. I'm looking there where a... Right. Right. So the spirit that was in him was preventing him from speaking. And evidently preventing him from hearing also. No, but it's evidently been going on for some time. Okay, so Jesus rebukes him in verse 23, and then Mark writes in verse 24, immediately the father of the child cried out and said with tears, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. You know, poor guy, I mean, you can understand where he's coming from. He knows, he recognizes, I have a problem, but so does my son. Please help me. Help my unbelief so that my son can be healed. When Jesus saw that the people came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, deaf and dumb spirit, I command you, come out of him and enter him no more. Then the spirit cried out, we don't know what he said, convulsed him greatly and came out of him, and he became as one dead, so that many said, he is dead. Now, what is the significance of that? We've seen this before, that someone who's been possessed with an unclean spirit, once the spirit is out, the person is just laying there. Whereas when Jesus healed someone who couldn't walk or something like that, they're all of a sudden getting up and walking around. It's like there's two different results. Why do you think it's such here, Tracy? Okay, and whereas the person who was paralyzed, like we saw that, was that back in Mark 2, where they let the man down through the roof? Yes. You know, he was paralyzed, now he gets up and walks and carries his stuff that he's got. So that's right, the Lord sets it up so people are doing the opposite of what they had been doing. And anyways, he says he's not dead, verse 27, but Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up and he arose. So now the disciples are curious. And when he had come into the house, his disciples asked him privately, why could we not cast it out? So he said to them, this kind can come out by nothing but prayer, and some translations add, and fasting. Well, I gather two things from that. Number one, there's different kinds of unclean spirits. Maybe some are more powerful than others, or something of that nature. And then number two, it seemed, I get the idea that Jesus is implying that there's something they hadn't done, which would be what? Yeah, they hadn't prayed. Now, why would that be important?
I don't know. But that was the difference in what it seemed to be discussed, the fact that the spirit was deaf and mute.
Okay.
And that wasn't in there. The other, I was trying to think of another incident with the gasoline or what the guy that was so strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, something's different here, and while the apostles have the power didn't reside in them. The power came from above, and they needed to remember that. Oh yes, right. The spirit could hear, right. Exactly, right. And of course, Jesus being who he is, he can do that. But, man, don't forget to pray. Whatever you're doing in life, don't forget to pray. That's right. And we're reminding ourselves, too, that He's the power, not us. Remember, go ahead, Glenda. I don't know. I don't know how to answer that question. I'm sure they right. I'm sure that they prayed. You know, they had a prayer life. I have no doubt about that. But they encountered a problem, and then didn't know what to do, and so they didn't then speak to God. You know, they should have been, what they should have done was, rather than waiting for Jesus to come and take care of the situation, and then ask them the question, they should have gone to the Father in prayer and asked the same question. How come we cannot cast this out? And then He may have answered, you know, such and such. Just like, you know, I think all of us in here have a regular prayer life, but sometimes we get caught up in doing our own things that we forget to pray specifically about something, to pray specifically about a difficult situation or whatever. And the example I was going to think of is Joshua chapter 9, the Gibeonites were part of the Canaanites. And God had given the command that they were to wipe out all the Canaanites, all the people who lived in the land. And they started to do it. The Gibeonites heard about this. They heard about Israel's wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. They heard about the plagues in Egypt. They heard about the part in the Red Sea, and they feared. So, you remember, they got together some moldy bread and clothes torn up or, you know, whatever, to make it look like they came from a long ways away. And they made a covenant, an agreement with the Israelites, you know, not to destroy us. And then verse 14 of Joshua 9 says, they did not ask counsel of the Lord. And then they discovered, oh no, these are Canaanites. But they had already made an agreement with them to spare them. And that was such a serious thing that centuries later, when you come to King Saul, in his zeal, he killed some of the Gibeonites. And God cursed Israel for that. And it wasn't fixed until David became king. And then, pardon? That's right. And like we talked about in my class this past Sunday morning, when you make a promise, you have to keep it. And the Israelite leaders did that for the whole nation, which meant for all time. So anyways, that's kind of getting off track a little bit there, but don't ever forget to pray. And I'll use myself as an example. If you remember, I'm pretty sure it was a Wednesday night, several months ago, I remember I couldn't get anything right. Do you remember that? And I was so embarrassed, and I thought, I know what the problem is. I didn't pray before I started class. So I prayed right there on the spot, and everything went smooth from there. You know, so don't forget to pray about everything. And can. Right, if you can. Exactly, right. Tracy? Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but he needed to think again about who he was going to.
They were still learning about who he was at that time.
Well, but there's been a lot of miracles done already. And that's why he's bringing his son to Jesus, because, well, like back in chapter 7, you know, there was a casting out of a demon. I think also in chapter 2, I think at chapter 5, there was a demon cast out. And it seems like in a synagogue, yeah, in chapter 1, verse 21, he's cast out an unclean spirit. So Jesus has a record of doing this, and that's why he's gone to Jesus. But he's wondering, have I now got a problem that's too big for Jesus of Nazareth to handle? And he's not really thinking about who the Lord is. Okay, so now a new situation. Verse 30. Then they departed from there and passed through Galilee, and he did not want anyone to know it. Why would that be? I thought he wanted everyone to know him. He needed some time with them, okay? And we've seen him already a couple of times become frustrated that people just want things from him. And so it's getting to the point where he's so popular and people are going to him for the wrong reasons that he just has to say, I got to get away from people, at least for a while. Yes. No more free food. Yeah. That's right. Yep. 31. For he taught his disciples and said to them, the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and after he is killed, he will rise the third day. But they did not understand this saying and were afraid to ask him. Well, he's rebuked them a couple of times for things, hasn't he? So they're getting to the point where we don't understand what he's saying, but who wants to ask, you know? How about you, Peter? You're always speaking. Why don't you do it? And so evidently not even Peter wanted to do that. But to us, his words seem pretty plain in verse 31. And yet sometimes he speaks figuratively, like what he did about Elijah. So I wonder if they're thinking here, well, this can't be literal. I mean, after all, this guy can raise people from the dead. He heals the paralyzed. He casts demons out of people. He gives the blind sight and the deaf hearing. And he's going to let someone kill him? So now they're thinking, it can't be just that plain. There's got to be something else hidden here. That's right.
He's the one that's going to rule the world. He's the one they've been waiting for. Now he's talking about it being killed.
That's right, yeah, exactly. Then he came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, what was it you disputed among yourselves on the road? But they kept silent. These guys are embarrassed. For on the road they had disputed among themselves who would be the greatest. Now look what's going on here. Jesus is talking about dying, and what are they talking about? I'm greater than you are, Phil. You're supposed to say no. I'm greater than you are, Don. You know, that's what they're arguing about that. Yeah, they're not mature in their thinking yet, are they? Right. Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, they were embarrassed.
Yeah.
I think they were embarrassed. Now think about these men. And it's easy to be critical of them right here, but and while they were afraid to ask him about his death there in verse 31 and resurrection, yet in just a little while, they won't be able to talk about anything else but the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and they'll go out into all the world and talk about it till the day they die. Go ahead.
They've seen so many things, you know, that Peter, James, and John just saw transfiguration.
Right.
I would be all messed up inside my brain. What is this, you know?
Right.
Die, and, you know, and it doesn't make sense in their thing.
Yeah, I follow what you're saying. And you know what's interesting about the transfiguration, Phil, and it's not revealed here in Mark, but one of the other gospel accounts, I think it's Matthew's, that Moses and Elijah and Jesus were talking about his death. Because see here, where is that? Pardon? the discussion between those three men? Right. But here, I don't think it says what they were talking about in Mark, does it? It just says in verse 4 of Mark 9, and Elijah appeared to them with Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. But like I say, the other gospel accounts say the thing they were talking about was the death of Jesus. So it's coming up all the time. Go back to chapter 2 for a moment. Let's see here. 31. Well, why can't I find what I'm looking for? Okay, Jesus, I got a couple scriptures here where Jesus has referred to his death numerous times already, right here in Mark. And I was just studying it before class started, and I don't know where I saw it in my notes here. Okay, well, we'll just leave that. Okay, come back to chapter 9. Okay, so they're having that argument, and then Jesus, in verse 35, it's so fascinating to see the way he dealt with these men. And he sat down. If you're angry at someone, or disappointed in them, or whatever, or you want to give them a lecture, are you going to have a tendency to sit down? My tendency is to want to stand up. When I'm angry, I don't sit down. Maybe that's just me and maybe you're different. But I think his sitting down here shows his total calm spirit. These men, he's already selected these men. These men are going to go out and change the world forever. But they need to be changed first. Okay, so he sits down, called the 12 and said to them, if anyone desires to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all. So if you want to be the first, you actually need to be the opposite. If you want to be the greatest, you need to be the opposite.
The most humble.
That's right. Remember Jesus in another place said, whoever exalts himself, what? Shall be abased or shall be humbled. And he who humbles himself shall be exalted or lifted up. Okay. So then verse 36, he took a little child and set him in the midst of them, and when he had taken him into his arms, he said to them, whoever receives one of these little children in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me. Now we're going to see Jesus a little bit later do the same thing with children as far as taking them in his arms. And he picked up this child in his arms, verse 36. What did Jesus think about children?
He loved them.
And he made humans to start out as children. That's right. That's right. And he actually says in verse 37, there's something that us adults need to learn from children.
We need to become children.
That's right. And we often think that the children need to learn from us. And that's true. But can we learn anything from children? There's a lot we can learn from them. Okay, so if I receive a child in the name of Christ, who am I actually receiving? And if I'm receiving Christ, who am I actually receiving? God the Father. You receive one, you receive the other. Okay, so verse 38. Now John answered him. Look at how John responds to all this, okay? I wonder if John's trying to cover up something here. Or trying to redeem himself. Now, John answered him saying, Teacher, we saw someone who does not follow us casting out demons in your name, and we forbade him because he does not follow us. Now, isn't that interesting? Jesus just gave this little discussion about who's going to be the first one, who's going to be the great one. And he's just been embarrassed because the Lord knows that they were arguing about who's the greatest. And then what does John do?
Since he answers him.
Pardon?
He uses the word
answer him. Right. This was his comeback. His comeback. The word answer doesn't necessarily mean answering a question, but it's a comeback, a response. So his response was, look what I did, Lord. And I'm doing this for you. I'm honoring you. But look what Jesus says. Do not forbid him. For no one who works a miracle in my name can soon afterwards speak evil of me. For he who is not against us is on our side. For whoever gives you a cup of water to drink in my name, because you belong to Christ, assuredly I say to you, he will by no means lose his reward. Okay, so let's go back to John's declaration there in verse 38. Was this guy really casting out demons? He was, wasn't he, Dorothy? And he was casting out demons in whose name? In the name of Jesus. So, where do you think he got that power?
Only come from one source, Jesus.
For he got it from Jesus. So evidently, Jesus had gotten together with this man away from the apostles. They never knew about it. And Jesus gave him this power. So the man is truly casting demons out of people, and he's doing it in the name of Christ, and John says, stop doing that. Because you're not one of us. We're the 12. It almost sounds to me like John's still thinking about who's the greatest. He's not necessarily disputing about who's greatest among the 12, but who's greatest among all the people in Israel. Is it the apostles or someone else?
They thought they were going to be like David's top men or something, have control and authority.
That's right. And in some ways they were going to, weren't they? But
different than what they were.
Yes, right. I was just talking with someone today about the brutal, horrible treatment that all of the apostles received once they started preaching Christ, you know, after the resurrection. So they're going to have honored places. Well, they do in our hearts, don't they? I mean, you know, we read their stuff and we think very highly of them. And of course, they're in heaven now, except for Judas. But like Earl's saying, what they're going to experience on the earth is far different than what they think they're going to experience. And then once they have a change of heart, they have no problem with that. They have no problem with suffering brutal persecution for Jesus. History says that all of the apostles were killed except for John. He was the only one who died on up into old age. But he was also persecuted. Okay.
He was banished, wasn't he?
To the island of Patmos. That's right. And the story is that he had been cast into a large kettle of boiling oil, and God saved him miraculously from it. So there's nothing, the Romans figure, there's nothing we can do to this guy, so let's stick him on the island of Patmos. And then God gives him the revelation. Right. Yeah, I hadn't heard that before. And he was in his 90s when he died, from what we understand. Alrighty, class, we'll begin at verse 42 next week.